Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
Hey there, Pronate Dad Podcast. My name is Mike Rogan. I am the owner and editor of Mountain Gazette. If you notice these ads, I'm usually skiing or doing something related to being outdoors. But at the moment, we're actually working on Mountain Gazette 201, our spring issue. And rather than explain why the magazine's great, why you should subscribe, I just want you to know, I love making magazines. Making magazines is the best thing I do in my entire life. It is so fulfilling and so rewarding. So I just want to take a minute to say thank you to all the subscribers that have made this possible for us in our 3.5 year journey to revive this magazine and return it to glory. Learn more at mountaingazette.com and enjoy the podcast.
The latest release from Commercial Type, Ionic Modern, is the perfect typeface for editorial projects in print and on screen. Available to see and test at commercialtype.com.
Here in the Green Mountains of Vermont, we print magazines. We're Lane Press and we've been doing this since 1904. We don't print books, journals, or signs, just magazines. All of our equipment is made for that, and all of our craftspeople specialize in it. We print for prestigious colleges and universities, for business-to-business brands. We print regional, association, niche, and newsstand titles. And we would love to print your magazine. To learn more, visit us at lanepress.com.
I don't want to get ahead of myself about Allure, but it was deliberately aggressive and deliberately not pretty. I was going to say ugly. It wasn't ugly, but it wasn't trying to be pretty. We didn't want to be pretty. And Alex Lieberman kept saying, we don't want any visions of loveliness. And he kept repeating that, no visions of loveliness. So I think that was a little jarring to people who had a different expectation of what this was going to be.
This is Print is Dead, Long Live Print, a podcast about magazines and the people who made and make them. I'm Deborah Bishop.
I'm Rachel Baker.
I'm Maggie Bullock.
I'm Patrick Mitchell. You've loved our collaborations with The Spread. Their episode 21 interview with former Cosmo editor-in-chief Joanna Coles remains one of our most downloaded shows. Now, Rachel Baker and Maggie Bullock are back again, this time with the queen of the beauty magazines, Allure founding editor Linda Wells. You can find The Spread every week on Substack, where Rachel and Maggie round up juicy gossip from the New York Times to The Drift and everywhere in between. Big ideas and deeply personal examinations of women's lives to create their idea of the perfect women's magazine. Here's Rachel and Maggie with Linda Wells.
Picture it. It's 1991. You're sitting at your desk at the New York Times when you get a call from the office of Condé Nast's Alexander Lieberman. Alex wants to meet you at La Grenouille for lunch to discuss an opportunity. Cy Newhouse has decided to launch the first ever beauty magazine, and he thinks you're just the woman to make it happen. 31 years old. The canvas is blank. The budget is endless. What's your move, Linda Wells?
For the women's magazine editors of today, struggling to keep the lights on by juggling Instagram, TikTok, marketing events, digital content, and whatever remains of their print product, this is a tale so far-fetched it feels like the stuff of an early aughts rom-com. But millennial editors' wildest ideas about the quote-unquote town car era of magazine making were just another day at the office for Linda Wells. Linda led Allure for 25 years, becoming a front row fixture at Fashion Week while also pioneering the cottage industry of backstage beauty coverage and enlisting writers like Arthur Miller, Isabel Allende, Betty Friedan, and John Updike to write about beauty. In 2018, she pivoted, restyling herself as a beauty entrepreneur, launching with Revlon a makeup range she called Flesh. Now she's back in the land of editorial, having a bunch of fun at the helm of the beauty vertical of Graydon Carter's Airmail, commissioning articles on everything from psychedelics to orgasm coaches. We knew Linda Wells would be delightful, and yet she exceeded our expectations. We know you'll love her too.
You wanna do this? Should we do this?
We're doing it.
Eddie. Great. So Linda, as we record this, people are flying home from Europe for Fashion Week, and they're all seeing their children for the first time in weeks and unpacking. And I wonder, like, where are you with that? Do you still do any of the circuit? Is it a relief not to do the circuit? Tell us where you sit.
Yeah, I don't do the circuit anymore. I, every once in a while, will get an invitation and it's, oh, you don't have to have me there. I loved it when I did it, but it was really exhausting. And I know, boo-hoo, you're going to all the fashion shows. What a terrible hardship that is. But it's a lot. I always think about it. If you really love ice cream and then someone says you have to have it every single meal and you can't stop having it until midnight, but then you've got to wake up at 5 the next morning and have it. It's a lot of sweet goodness stuffed into a very short period of time with high heels on. And I think that was the other piece of it that was a killer, was you had to get dressed every day. And that really intimidated me. I hated the packing for it. It would just send me into such a tailspin. And then just the whole pressure of looking good and being photographed. It's not who I am. I like being behind the scenes. And so it just felt like a lot of public activity and not a lot of time to think. I always brought a book. And then, of course, when books became obsolete, I brought a Kindle or an iPad or whatever, and I would read while everybody else was chit-chatting. Chit-chat before the show is exhausting because it was 45 minutes of chit-chat.
With the same people that you just saw at the last one.
I was like the rude person reading a book, but it just was a way for me to escape.
Yeah. That is so interesting, too, because I definitely perceived you as someone of like unshakable confidence who could sit in front of all those cameras and dress for all the... And honestly, the idea that caused you any kind of agita is like a genuine surprise to me.
Yes. Oh, no, absolutely. And it was always like, you're not thin enough, you're not young enough. Even when you are young enough, you're not thin enough. And I never personalized like the models. The models part of it to me was like, they were a different species up there. People would always say, isn't it depressing to look at models all day? And I'm like, no, I don't think I'm like them. They're just, there's no relationship. But it was just that expectation, I think, and the expectation of all these fashion editors. And they really do dress the part. And I think they come to the job at the very beginning as people who really like to wear clothes and try on clothes and change their clothes. I don't like to change clothes. If I put on something in the morning, that's what I'm wearing to dinner.
I don't want to take us too far off track, but my personal theory has always been that people who grew up to be fashion editors are often people who had a really easy relationship with clothes. Like they didn't feel conflicted and terrible about themselves when they tried on new clothes because they're thin and beautiful mostly and whatever, they fit that ideal. I know I'm really vastly oversimplifying and many uncountable hours have probably been spent in the therapy chairs of fashion editors. Right. But I did always think that's a little bit easier for you to love clothes in an uncomplicated way. Is the way that it seemed to me.
What's the beauty equivalent? What's in people's head who become beauty editors?
I think that's become a prerequisite in a way of being a beauty editor. It didn't used to be because beauty editors were really much more behind the scenes. You'd go to events, but the events weren't public events. They were meeting with a brand or learning about a new product or going to a launch, but it wasn't really that outward facing. And so now, if you're a beauty editor with any value at all, you've got a great big Instagram account and you post Get Ready With Me and you put on your technique and you show everything. And it's like, I'm not that person either. You can do a winged eye in the back of an Uber. And that's not me. So I think that there's that kind of expectation of a certain amount of personal skill that's not about being the editor or being a writer or being any of those things. It's about makeup skills and hair skills.
Performance.
Yeah. And that was not what the job used to be. So it's a lot harder, I think, for beauty editors today.
Or it's just a totally different skill set, right?
That's true.
So actually going in the Wayback Machine, how did little Linda Wells at Trinity College, would she have ever envisioned this kind of future, this kind of career, you know, reading up on her books and writing her papers?
Right. That's all I cared about. No. And really, when I graduated, I didn't have a career plan. I didn't have a job, which is unthinkable for people who are graduating from college now. They've got their whole strategy. They've had all their internships. I wasn't that person. I didn't really even know or think about life that way. And no one in my family was from this world. They were all finance people. So I graduated and I was really at a loss of what I was going to do because what I wanted to do was go to graduate school. My father was like, sorry, no. And I went to New York and interviewed with everybody, graphic design firms and ad agencies and book publishing and then magazine. I interviewed at Hearst and I interviewed at Condé Nast. And got the job at Condé Nast as a, they had this program called Rover, the Rover program. And it was for the most green beginners ever who knew nothing. And they would put you in different jobs where there was an opening. So let's say the assistant to the assistant to the shoe editor was sick. Then it'd stick you there for a couple of days until the assistant got better. And what you would do is take shoes down to the messenger room, or you'd Xerox shoes, or you'd mark up shoes and put them away. It was like being in an Amazon warehouse, but a really nice one.
But you did eventually land more full-time in the beauty department at Vogue. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I got a full-time job in the beauty department as an assistant there. So that was my step up.
That's actually my first real job, too, in the beauty department of Vogue. It's under Sarah Brown, actually. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It was a very different place when I was there. It was a Grace Mirabella world. Cool. And Anna Wintour was there as the creative director about a year into when I was there.
Tell us about Grace Mirabella. Were you so low on the totem pole that you didn't really interact?
I didn't really interact with her much. When I decided to leave and got this job at the New York Times, I was packing up my boxes and she came in and said, "Kiddo, don't leave." And I thought, "You don't know my name, do you?"
Were you a natural fit as a Vogue girl? Did that shape you in some way, that experience? Obviously, it's a larger than life, like cultural idea now to be a Vogue person, but What was your experience like?
I did feel a little bit like I felt the turnip truck, because I was born in New York, but I spent 4 years of high school in St. Louis. And so I felt like I had a bit of a Midwestern in me. And so I think that was at odds a bit with what the atmosphere was. And then everyone was really well dressed and they wanted to look like they belonged there. So there was that part of it that felt at odds. And then the funny thing about this, and I don't know whether you experienced this, Maggie, but being an editor at Vogue, and even just at the lowest level, an assistant at Vogue, there was the assumption that you had to live and breathe and act as if you were the Vogue reader and the Vogue editor all rolled into one. So you became, or I became, the biggest snob ever about tiny things. I'm making no money. I can't afford a taxi. I have an attitude about where the best vacation is, or is it Capri better than the Amalfi Coast? Who am I?
It is a really weird psychology. Also, you're living in a shoebox. You're eating ramen.
I ate ramen. If I wasn't living on hors d'oeuvres, I'd go to events and have lots of hors d'oeuvres. But yeah, and then you would be a snob about, I don't know, where you got a facial or what cream you would use. And you weren't going to go to the drugstore and buy something. It would be so déclassé.
Yes. I'm still completely broken by this. Rachel can confirm that I'm still broken in that way. So then afterwards, as you just mentioned, you left Vogue and you went to the New York Times. That was a really cool job, right? You were at the Times Magazine, correct?
So I started the paper and I was a bit of a fish out of water, to put it very mildly. And it was tough because I was brought in, I thought, to bring beauty to the pages of the, not make them beautiful, but cover the beauty industry, not so much as a business, but as trends and things like that. I was on what was loosely called the living style desk. It wasn't the style that we know today. And so I kept pitching story ideas and they were just like, these are not what we do at the New York Times. And so I got panicky because I was on trial. They put you on trial for 3 months before they hired me. So I had to get a whole lot of bylines pulled together before I was going to be hired. I agreed to do whatever they would throw at me. So I ended up covering a lot of the evening parties and getting all dressed up and taking my reporter's notebook and an evening bag and going out to the Pier and to ballrooms around New York and covering events. And it was hilarious, I have to say. If you want to be really popular at a party, at least pull out a reporter's notebook and you will be like, people would flock to me and tell me things. They wanted so badly to be in the paper. And sometimes I went around with Bill Cunningham, and that was a great introduction to that world. So I was doing that, and Carrie Donovan was the editor of the New York Times Magazine, the style part of it. And she saw that, I probably saw that I was floundering. And so she rescued me and brought me to the magazine. And that was much more a natural fit. And then I wrote every other week about beauty in the magazine. And then about a year in, I became the food editor too. The food editor quit, so I got that job too. And it was really two jobs. And so I did both of those things.
How did you know about food?
I know, it was random, but I've always been really obsessed with food and I've always cooked and took cooking classes and was just a personal interest. And I think, again, I was on trial for 3 months. I did a proposal. I did the work for 3 months and they said, yes, you can stay. So it was an odd mix, but it was something that was incredibly fun. And it was a very fertile time for food because it was a time when Daniel Boulud broke out on his own and Jean-Georges Vongerichten came to the U.S. And there were just these superstars that we all know now, but at the time they were just breaking out on their own. So it was fun.
That is cool. But I'm noticing, too, that you had Grace Mirabella and then Carrie Donovan.
Yes.
So what did you learn from Carrie Donovan?
Oh, my God. I learned everything from Carrie. She just was the most fantastic boss. I loved her so much. I learned that your boss could be more than just a boss. They could be an example of how to live. They could be a friend. I ended up scattering her ashes with another person who worked for her from the Pont Neuf in Paris. We were really close and she really rooted for me. So I felt great about that. And she took me everywhere. She introduced me to Ralph Lauren and to Karl Lagerfeld and all the world of fashion and took me to the shows and introduced me to Calvin Klein and all the biggies. And that was great because there was no better introduction. But she also taught me about how to work with people and how to spare their egos. And I hope I learned that from her, to take good care of people who are creative, because it's not easy to put yourself out there like that. And she had this way of, even if she was killing a story or killing a photo shoot, she'd bring the photographer in or have a conversation and they'd leave looking like they were walking on air and smiling. And she just had a way of magically seducing people. She was really exceptional.
Wow.
She taught me a lot. And she was brutally honest, too. So when I started Allure, she looked that first issue and I took her out for lunch and she was just like, oh, this is not good. She went through and told me all about why.
Did you agree with her? Was she right?
She had points. The thing is, I also think when someone gives you criticism, it's a gift. So I wanted to pay attention to it and take it in and not become defensive. We were doing something. I don't want to get ahead of myself about Allure, but it was deliberately aggressive. And deliberately not pretty. I was going to say ugly. It wasn't ugly, but it wasn't trying to be pretty. We didn't want to be pretty. So I think that was a little jarring to people who had a different expectation of what this was going to be. It took a little while.
Yeah. So just to rewind it back just a minute. Yeah. Okay. You were like, I don't know, 30 when Cy Newhouse called you and asked you to create a beauty magazine.
Yeah.
Scratch. Can you tell us what was that call like?
It was Alex Lieberman, who was the editorial director of Condé Nast and the creative side. Cy was the business side and Alex was the creative side. And Alex wanted to have lunch at La Grenouille. And I thought, that's a little public. I don't know. Because that was like, it was a place that a lot of these people went for lunch all the time. And I thought, Condé Nast had been trying to hire me back. And Anna Wintour had tried to hire me back to Vogue to be a beauty editor, beauty director. And I really loved being at the time, so I didn't really want to go back and do something at a place I'd already been. So when Alex called me to have lunch, I just thought that's what he was doing. And I just thought that would be not very thoughtful to Carrie Donovan, whose relationship was really important to me. So I said, could we have lunch in your office or a meeting in your office as opposed to at a very public place? And so I went to meet with Alex and we went to Cy's office and I was like, oh, maybe this is about something else. And it was a very simple conversation. And if you had ever met Cy or heard about Cy, he was a man of very few words and very long pauses, very long pauses. You had to try your very hardest not to fill in that pause.
Yikes.
So I went to his office and Cy said, basically, I want to start a beauty magazine and I want you to be the editor. And that was it. I mean, he said also I wanted to be journalistic. And then I got on my high horse and said, if it's going to be journalistic, then we can't be beholden to the advertisers, because Condé Nast was very advertising friendly. And there was the fantastic example of Condé Nast Traveler, which had started a few years before us. But Truth and Travel was their sort of subhead, and they were going to be critical of the travel industry. But it was different in the beauty world because beauty had never had anybody criticize anything that they did. And it was a very close relationship between advertising and editorial. And I learned at the New York Times, where I was really encouraged to be tough and encouraged to be critical. And when the big companies, all the big beauty companies would complain about something that I did or wrote, usually the top editors would come and congratulate me. My bosses and Abe Rosenthal, they were thrilled. Good, go for it. They wanted it to be tough. It was a different scenario at Condé Nast that didn't really have that approach to these subjects. And also, our advertising was going to be beauty. So unlike the travel magazine, not all of its advertising was travel advertising. A lot of it was, but not all of it. But for us, we were going to be critical of the very people who were supporting us. So that was a bit of a process to figure out how we were going to do that.
Wow. My next question was going to be, what kind of hoops did you have to jump through to ultimately get the job? But it sounds like they knew they wanted you and you pushed back on them, which is incredible. How old were you then?
I think I was 31 when we started. I think I was hired in April of 1990. So yeah, I wasn't really pushing back. Of course I was going to take the job. I'm not crazy. It was a good chance to start your own magazine with the support of Condé Nast, which is, there's nothing in the world like that kind of financial support and also support for you as an editor. They just really stood behind their editors. It wasn't so much that, it was just, let's be sure that we agree what this is and what this means. So I didn't say yes to the offer in that room that day, but I did later that very day. So I was thrilled to be there.
What was happening in the beauty world at that time that made Cy and Alex be like, we got to do a beauty magazine and we need Linda?
It was still a kind of quiet time in the beauty world. It was before Retin-A was approved by the FDA. And I always think of that as a watershed moment because it was the first time that a prescription medication to make you look better was approved. But with a marriage of science and beauty in a really legitimate way, it was still really early days. But what they knew was that those beauty pages in the Condé Nast magazines, particularly Vogue, Glamour, were really successful. They had very high readership and they had built-in advertising. So I think that they saw that and saw the way that the New York Times was covering it and thought that could be a good territory for Condé Nast.
We'll be right back.
Print is Dead is made possible with the support of Mag Culture. Read our online journal, listen to our podcast, and visit our shop to discover why we're convinced print is very much alive. All available at magculture.com.
So what was your vision like in that the form of a beauty magazine?
At the time, it was really taking my only two experiences, which is Vogue and the New York Times, and mashing them up together. So it was like the visual excellence of Vogue and the journalistic excellence of the Times and try to see if those two things could be pushed together. And in the end, we didn't go with quite the visual excellence of Vogue because a number of different reasons, but the short version is that I was a little afraid of it being too pretty and too predictable and a little obvious. And Alex Lieberman kept saying, we don't want any visions of loveliness. And he kept repeating that, no visions of loveliness. He wanted it not to look like one of those magazines that you found in a beauty salon. This was such a long time ago that it's hard to remember. Beauty was a very reverential, pristine, retouched, perfect concept of a very narrow definition in every way. And beauty photographs were really quite limited too. Most photographers shot fashion. So we'd be like, crop in. They'd crop in on the picture to make a beauty picture. But it was really the advertising world that had all the creativity and beauty. And it didn't exist in a very big way in magazines. So it was trying to figure out how we were going to interpret beauty and talk about it and make it exciting. And it was a time of MTV and it was tabloids and it was a rougher time. And I think that we wanted to pick up that kind of energy. So the layouts and the design ended up looking very much like that world.
And then you also put a lot of energy into making it quite literary, right?
Yeah. I think that the assumption is that beauty is superficial and vain and hence not smart and not provocative or complicated. And to me, the reason that I found the subject interesting was because people have really conflicted opinions about the way they look, the way they present themselves to the world, the beauty standards. All these things are really fraught. And it became a subject of feminism. It became a subject of politics. There are a lot of issues in there that I think magazines weren't really parsing very much and dissecting. And so I wanted to be able to do that, not just in reporting, but also to have real writers, literary writers, explore the subject. So it was fulfilling a fantasy because I love to read and I love great writers. So I read Country Girls by Edna O'Brien and got her to write for the first issue and put her on contract. And we had those great Condé Nast budgets. And so people would write for us. And I'd say write for us. And sometimes people would say, well, I need a new couch. So sure. Okay. If that's what it takes, I don't care what you're using the money for, just write for us. So we had Arthur Miller, we had Edwige Danticat, we had Isabel Allende, Geraldine Brooks, Betty Friedan, Diane Ackerman. I mean, it was an exceptional group of writers. David Sedaris on the really early days, Faye Weldon. And they would immediately think that we wanted them to write about something like makeup, or they didn't feel like they belonged in the magazine, or they wanted to approach it in an obvious way. And we would talk to them about, what does it mean to you? And what was your vision of beauty? And what was your interaction? And how did you feel about this? And then they just really would dive in. And it was always the most fantastic surprise what we would get from these writers.
And tell us, how did you get Updike to write about psoriasis?
I know, John Updike. We really wanted John Updike to write for us. And I loved what he was writing for The New Yorker. And we had several editors over the years who interacted with these writers and had relationships with them. And generally, I would hire them from The New Yorker, and they were assistant level people, and they would have this senior job, and they would have a great Rolodex. So we went through Mary Turner, and she would write these letters. And it was letters. It was in the mail, because John Updike wasn't on email. And so we'd send him letters about story ideas that we'd have. And he would send us back postcards that you buy at the post office, that there was, and he would type on the little postcard. It was pre-stamped, and it was almost like an index card. And he would very politely reject our ideas, but in a way that made us feel humiliated. And we'd be like, oh, this is so embarrassing. And we'd go back and try again. And he wrote something for The New Yorker about spending the summers with all the women whose husbands went to the city to work, and while they were with their kids on the beach, because he had psoriasis, and he would hang out and sunbathe while they were playing with the kids. And this became his group of friends and how he would spend his days. And so I thought, that's a beauty story. He wrote a story about that. We just sent him that idea. And suddenly we got this envelope, and in it was the manuscript, and there was no contract and no agreement. And there it was. And of course it was perfect. And we called it The Prodigal Son, S-U-N. And it was such an excitement. We were so thrilled.
Do any of these stories live in an archive? Can you find them?
I can't find them. I don't know why, but Allure doesn't have an archive like that. You can search for Kim Kardashian's, you know, hair color, but you can't search for John Updike psoriasis. And I don't know
that
why.
That is sad. That is really sad. A personal question, because I did start out in beauty. I just wondered how you talked about these stereotypes of beauty being a less serious subject. I just wondered how you, on a personal level, have dealt with or played with that stereotype about what it means to be a beauty person.
I guess in a way, I don't really think of myself as that. I'm not someone who gets a lot of facials or wears a lot of makeup. I don't personalize it. And I think that's really true of almost everything that I've done. It's not personalized. And so I look at it as a fascinating subject to pull apart and explore and see what it means about us as a culture. But I don't look at it as, how can I look better or how do I look? I care about the way I look, but I don't care that much about the way I look. I'm one of those people who looks in the mirror and then goes about my day. And I feel sorry for people today because everyone's on Zoom and they're photographing themselves. And I think there's a requirement now in the beauty world to be a beautiful person in a literal way. And that's not fun, you know, and I'm not young, and none of that bothers me in the sense of me doing my job.
So these last couple of months, there's been some chatter about the Town Square era of magazines, and you landed at Condé Nast as an editor-in-chief right in the middle of that. What do you make of that image that everybody's talking about once again?
The hilarious thing is everybody was talking about it all the time. I would laugh, and I'd like every profile of every editor would start, and she steps out of her town car in her high heels, so clickety-click across the sidewalk. And I'm like, here we go again. And it was a great time. It was a really fun time to be an editor because Condé Nast took care of us. They, Cy Newhouse, believed that we should be living like our subjects and out in the world. And so the indulgences were many. And it was almost as if you were looked down upon if you didn't take advantage of them, if you didn't spend enough money. And it was like, you were not rewarded for having a tight budget. Eventually, yes, that was important. But in the first 10 or 15 years I was there, that was not the attitude at all. It was excessive.
And what were the perks? Will you tell us? Did you have an interest-free mortgage?
I had an interest-free mortgage. That was really great. I mean, eventually, you know, I had to pay it back. That was shocking. Everything isn't free. And so, yes, I had an interest-free mortgage. And it was funny because when I got there, I didn't know any of these things. And I was coming from the times where you didn't get anything. You didn't, for the most part, you didn't take a pen home at night. I got there and I didn't know this until well in. I got a call from Human Resources and they said, oh, we have a car for you, meaning car for me to have to drive, not a town car, which yes, I had that town car thing. So I was like, oh, that's fantastic. It was a former ad director's car and she left. And so I got her old car. And I thought, this is the greatest thing going. And then people were like, you're crazy. That's someone's old car. You should be getting a new car and you should be getting a better car because you're an editor in chief. You don't stick around for this Hyundai thing or whatever it was. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I was so happy to have a car. And I didn't know really what was available to me. But once it was available to me, believe me, I went for it. So I was trip to the Concorde. And Michael Jackson was on my flight one time, and it was rooms plural at the Ritz. When I had kids, I brought my kids to the fashion shows and the nanny, and we all holed up at the Ritz. And I had a bassinet that used to be someone else's bassinet, and then I'd keep it in storage at the Ritz, and then I passed it along to another editor at another magazine, and it was extreme. I remember one time the CEO, Steve Florio, was supposed to moderate a panel discussion in Detroit at Chrysler. And the last minute, he decided he couldn't do it or he didn't want to do it. And he called me begging for me to do it. And I was like, okay, sure, I'll go. And he said, I'll fly you there in a private plane and I'll get you anything you want, a Prada. And I said, fine. And then I ended up, I was on Northwest Airlines. I'm like, who are all these people? This is not a private plane. So, you know, and then he was like, not available to go with me to Prada for shopping. Now, can you imagine going with the CEO shopping at Prada? But then I end up saying, why don't I do this? I'll just go to Prada, I'll get something, and I'll send you the receipt. But that was like kind of the grandiosity of it. And I remember one time there was an advertiser who was very unhappy about what we had published in Allure. And this happened all the time, by the way. Unhappy advertisers all the time. And that's the consequences of being a journalist in this field. So this advertiser was a part of a huge organization, a very big beauty company, one of the largest. And he decided he was angry. We wrote a story about, does hair dye cause cancer? And we did all this research and the research said that it did not, that it was clear. And so it was a lot of just apocryphal rumors and things like that. He was so angry that we even asked the question. He said to me, I'm going to destroy you and your magazine. He called me to tell me that. So he tried to get all of the beauty companies in the U.S. to band together and to boycott Allure, no advertising, no editorial coverage. He was going to put a stop to us. And so this culminated in a meeting that he decided to have like December 23rd, maybe it was the 24th. And my whole family went down to the Caribbean on vacation with my little kids and my husband and the nanny. And I was in New York meeting with angry advertisers. The CEO, Steve, felt so terrible about it that he sent me down to Antigua on a private plane. I had a much better experience. I was like, I did my work and I got to Antigua without it. It was fantastic. And they didn't pull the advertising. And it turned out that the advertiser was retiring on January 1st. And so this was going to be his last act. But as I walked into the elevator after we had this meeting, he gave me a kiss on two cheeks and happy holidays. And I was like, what are you talking about? You went after me.
And tried to get the whole industry to go after me too.
That was cute.
Just cute.
So cute. You launched in 1990, right?
91 was the first
91
issue. And I was starting to work there in 90. Yeah.
So you were right where you needed to be when this whole era of the celebrity really took off. The idea of celebrities on the cover of the magazine instead of the models. What was the turning point or the point at which you were like, whoa, we've entered a new phase? Does that stand out in your mind?
Yeah. It was because we were very much wedded to the model. I came around when the supermodel was hitting its peak. And so that was really exciting. It was like that moment where Gianni Versace was alive and had all the girls on the runway at one time and the power of that whole group. And there was nothing better than if you could get Linda on a cover and Cindy and Christy and Naomi. It was that really great moment of beauty and models and larger than life characters. And while that was happening, the actors were really downplaying beauty and wearing Converse high tops and big dresses and no hair and makeup. It wasn't a time of really glam squads and things that happen now. So then InStyle came along and really made celebrity their identity. And they were having huge success in it. And you just felt the balance shift. And I think it was partly that the designers became uninterested in the supermodels in the same way because they felt the supermodels were getting too much attention. And they ended up getting all those Eastern European models who were very anonymous and looked all alike. And so the personalities disappeared from the runways and from fashion, and celebrities became the big personalities. And they started claiming fashion and beauty as something they wanted to participate in. And that meant they would get contracts with fashion brands. And so it shifted in a big way. The whole business shifted to a more celebrity-driven business. And I remember, I think our first celebrity cover was Sharon Stone. And that was funny because we were shooting her. I think the first cover was shot by Herbert. So that was a different shoot, but we shot her previously. And we had borrowed for the shoot a gown from John Galliano. And it was like one of a kind, embroidered silk. It was an incredible dress. And she was about to get in the dress. She was in a hotel room when we were shooting her. And she said, "Oh, you know my rule, don't you? I wear it, I keep it." And the stylist on the shoot called me up in a panic. Sharon Stone says that if she wears the dress, she's going to keep the dress. And I'm like, that's not our dress to give her. So I think she's going to be shot in the hotel robe. And that's what we did. We shot her in the hotel robe and she looked great. But that was that assumption on the part of the celebrity that I will get all the jewels and I will get all the things.
Sharon Stone loves a declaration. She's like, "It will be such. You will now give this to me." Also, on the other hand, nobody wears a robe better. Your backup plan was good.
The downside of the celebrity was the celebrity profile. There's only so much you can say after a while when everyone's covering the same people. There's just not that much more to bring to it. And one of the things that we started doing, and it started out as an accident, but we found all these pictures, I think first with Helen Hunt. We found all these pictures of her as a child actor and all through her days. We brought them to the interview and she looked at them and she commented on them. And that became our point of difference. And it was a moment of unrehearsed reaction. And it was a reaction to the way they looked, which is what we cared about at Allure, what they were wearing and what their hair was and their eyebrows. And there was always a comment and the comments were funny. And so that was just an element of humanity that didn't exist in a lot of the profiles. I think that GQ would get a great profile, but for the most part, it was very much a standard phoned in kind of predictable.
I loved those things. I still love that.
They were great.
Technique. It's such a smart way to crack them open.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was always surprising to me when they wouldn't expect it. And a few would get angry when we'd bring the pictures out. "I'm not doing this." And I'm like, "We do this in every issue. Who's not telling you? Someone's got to prep you." But it was really fun. And one of our best profiles was when Judith Newman went out to interview Britney Spears. And we'd photographed her first, which usually didn't happen. We usually got the story first and then the photograph. So we'd photographed her first. And so we were stuck. We had to run this thing. And every time they were supposed to meet, Britney would cancel and Britney would cancel and Britney would cancel. And Judith was there. And then she spent another day and she spent another day. And she lives in New York. She called me and I was like, "Can you stay a couple more days?" And she said, "Can you pay for my divorce?" So I said to her, "Write the story. Frank Sinatra has a cold. It's the story about celebrity for the celebrity who doesn't show up, the sort of empty vessel that celebrity actually is." And she wrote such a good piece.
We'll be right back.
Print is Dead is made possible by the support of the Society of Publication Designers. The SPD powers the future of visual storytelling, setting the standard for editorial excellence and shaping the future of visual culture. For more information, visit spd.org.
This feels like a bumpy pivot because we're talking about the highs, but can you tell us about the day when you got fired from Allure after so many years there? What was that like?
Actually, the funny thing was, it was surprising. Working for Condé Nast, what should never surprise you is that you will someday be fired. People were fired all the time. Magazines closed. I remember people saying, "I was abruptly fired." And I thought, what other way do they do it? And I know the famous Grace Mirabella was fired and she found out when she was watching Liz Smith on TV, some gossip report on local TV. It's never pretty and it's never easy, but I didn't expect it. And then again, of course, it seemed like it was time. I probably should have left before, but I didn't want to. I really liked it. And so I remember going back to my office and it was handled very strangely because they said they were going to announce the new editor at a certain time. And it was like, I would say it was in a half an hour. I was like, uh-oh, that doesn't mean very much time. And, you know, yes, you can stay and you can move up to the floor with all the executives and you can be on that floor and you can do whatever. And I thought, oh God, I don't want to do that. But I wasn't really thinking because it was such an out-of-body experience. So I went back to my office. I saw Paul Cavaco, who was the creative director and my work husband and who I adored so much. And I was like, I was just fired. He's like, what? So I said, we have to get everybody in the conference room immediately. And I went and told them, but I had no time to think about what I was going to say and how to prepare. And I was still in shock and people were crying and it was terrible. I felt like I was abandoning them. And I'm sure that they knew that this meant that it wasn't going to be so great for them either. And this had followed a lot of budget cuts. And before I was fired, I was asked to fire certain people who were paid a lot. And I thought, they're doing a good job. I don't really feel like I want to fire them. And I'm sure they thought, she's not going to be the right person to do these cuts, but I'm glad I didn't fire them. Can you imagine if I fired them and then I was fired? And then it was like, why don't I ruin people's lives who I felt were really great people? So I was spared that. And then I went back to my office and I thought, oh, I've got this full inbox. And then I was like, wait a second, that's not my problem anymore. And so I just walked out of the office and I never went back and I didn't go to the 78th floor or whatever floor it was. I just thought, it's just strange. If I'm going to go, I'm not going to hang around and pretend I have a job or act as if I'm a puppet up here. I don't want to do that. So I just left and that was that.
I heard you talk about this once and you said that everybody else is crying, but you did not cry. Is that true?
Yeah.
Or are you just not a crier?
I'm not much of a crier. Although if you get me on a TV show with a good song, I could fall apart really easily. No, I am a bit of a stoic and I think that it seems as if I have no emotions maybe, but I'm very placid on the outside and then inside of thinking about things. But no, I didn't cry. There was a moment where I just felt terrible for everybody, but I didn't cry for myself. And I don't think I really ever cried for myself about that. It was bad, but I did really feel as if that this chapter was over and it was time for me to move on and it was time for me not to feel bitter about it. There were a lot of people who were fired and were really angry about it for a long time. And I just didn't want it to ruin previous 25 years, which were great. And I was really proud of what we accomplished. And so I just thought, I'm not going to let that one day color my attitude about the previous 25 years. It was the end.
Just curious where you were in the arc of your generation of editors being fired or replaced. Had that turnover really started to happen already? And also, Rachel and I wondered if you are on a text chain with a bunch of them. Like, you know, did you console each other? You all went through this very unique experience, but you all went through it.
I feel like I was probably the first of the editors to go. And I remember Graydon Carter was really fantastic and took me out and we had lunch. And he's just, if you're going, it's just a matter of time before everybody goes. And he was very brilliant in the way that he executed his own departure. And it was so well done. And I think that people saw the writing on the wall, left before they were pushed out. But I think for Allure, it was tough because I felt that they just took a line in the salary and they just fired everybody over that line. I remember being on a text and seeing one person was gone. And then I was getting texts like, oh, they just fired X and they just fired this.
This is a little bit of a gear shift, but there's been such a revolution over the past decade in terms of inclusivity vis-a-vis beauty types and skin color and body ideals. Thinking back to Allure's heyday, how much of that was part of the conversation in making your magazine?
It wasn't a huge part of making the magazine. We included a variety of people, but it wasn't a daily conversation. And it's regrettable. I look back on it and I think that wasn't good. And I think that we fell into the same concept of what beauty was. And it was a narrow definition of what beauty was. And there were incidents like we did a shoot once where we had all these models lined up at a sink and they were wearing like what Snell thought of as Skims, but they were not Skims at the time. But it looked like that kind of beige underwear all lined up at a sink. And there was a dermatologist there and it was some kind of concept. And one of the models was significantly heavier than the others. And I got it back from the retoucher and her body was made to look like all the others. And the head of production came into me and she said, I'm really upset about this. And I'm like, what was it? And she showed it to me. I'm like, what happened to this model? And the photographer had gone and done it on his own and directed this. And I was like, oh my God. But that sort of showed me how it was just rote and how at every level, this is what was just commonly done and could be done because of the ease of retouching. There were just incidents like that that were visible issues, but it was a different time. And I don't even think it's fair to even defend it. It was just then. And it you look back, I think about the number of cover lines I had of lose 10 pounds. It was like I was fully delivering diet culture, beauty culture once a month, like clockwork. And that's not good.
We're also guilty. The number of cover lines I've written trying to rephrase weight loss stories.
Yeah.
They're countless. And the number of weight loss personal test drives I have done and written.
I'm a human guinea pig for all of them. And I have a tough time forgetting that because it's so part of my life from when I was a teenager. And I'm always thinking, I've got to lose weight, or I wish if I could just be a little bit thinner, my life would be perfect. But it's just like you get on the scale and it can make or break your day. And I know better, but it's just in your blood cells. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's really hard to shake.
Hard to shake.
So one thing that kind of bowls Rachel and I over, amongst many in your story, is that it felt like pretty quickly after you left Allure, you were reinventing yourself. You became Revlon's chief creative officer. And then a couple of years later, you launched your own beauty brand, Flash Beauty. This is a podcast called Print is Dead, and we're very much focused on that side of things. Obviously, now you're back on the editorial side. What's your kind of post-mortem on switching to the other theme for a while? And did you like being over there, or did you long to be back in editorial land?
It was such a great experience in terms of just learning something completely different, something I thought I knew, but knew from the outside and didn't know anything about from the inside. And in some ways, I wish I'd done it 20 years earlier so that I had that perspective, because it was fascinating. It's just, it's a different orientation, a different world. I learned that I'm not meant for the corporate world whatsoever. And even though people are like, Honey Nest is so corporate. Oh, no, it's not corporate. That's corporate. There's factories and there's supply chain. And the number of hours I spend in meetings about supply chain, and I don't know why I was there, but there I was sitting there trying to stay awake and also Googling acronyms under the table because I didn't know what I was talking about. But it was really interesting. And I was working for a CEO who came from Colgate and he went to Unilever, Fabian. He was fantastic. He wanted to have a better relationship with Ulta, and he saw what was happening with all the indie brands in beauty and thought, is there a way for us to create a brand internally that mimics the indie brand format, which is quick to market, no red tape, no deliberating, get it out fast and really trust your gut. So I raised my hand to do that. So it wasn't really my line, but I hired a makeup artist, I hired a designer, and I went with the makeup artist to Italy and we created the formulas and now I created the concept and we created the names and named all the products and made the identity and worked with our social media person to create an identity on Instagram. And it was so insanely fun. And that was a success in terms of what was asked of me. The challenge was that, but Revlon, they didn't work this way. They weren't in the prestige business. And it's a different business that requires a different kind of service in the store that you have to pay for. It requires marketing, merchandising, all these things that it just isn't, you set it up and then the people come. And it isn't, it's a new brand. So it was really doomed from the beginning, honestly. We had too many products. We didn't have a D2C presence. Everything that indie brands were doing, Glossier or you name it, was not the way we were doing it. We came out with something like 160 SKUs right off the bat, which is an insane amount of stuff. But what I cared about was the quality of the products and the way they looked and the way they sounded, their personality. And I love them. And I still have them and I still use them. I love those products. And they were great.
I love the name too. We love Flash.
It was so outrageous. We named one lip gloss Moist and people were just losing their minds about it. And we just had so much fun. It was so much fun.
So tell us about Airmail. You launched the beauty vertical Airmail Look last year. What was the mandate from Graydon there?
He brought me in to write about beauty and wellness for Airmail. And he is the greatest boss. He and Alessandra Stanley are the greatest bosses because they just let you do what you do. And sometimes I feel like my mission was, can I scandalize Graydon with this next story? But he's pretty unscandalizable, if that's a word. That was going along well. And I think the stories are really well received. And I think that was a big thing. And again, there's a built-in advertising interest in the subject. And he saw that this subject is just exploding. And so we started having conversations about what that would look like and how it would be. And he came up with the name, Airmail Look. And then he very generously had me work with a deputy editor from Airmail, Ashley Baker, who was my partner in crime and so much fun. And we talk every day. And we just came up with a lineup and off we went. And I have the art director and the creative director from Big Airmail. We call it Big Airmail because we're little. And then we have a photo editor who I knew from the Vanity Fair days, Susan White. So we have this incredible talent. And no one's full-time on Airmail Look, but we put our heart into it. It's enormously fun. We just laugh about, should we do this story? And we've got these outrageous stories.
You can really feel that as a reader.
Yeah.
Even like skimming the headlines this morning just to refresh my memory. I was like, oh, that's hilarious. What's your favorite story you worked on recently?
The story about the orgasm coach. There was nothing better. I don't know if you saw that one, but it was so hilarious. So a friend of mine, Lisa Eisner, was telling me, oh, there's this guy in LA and he teaches women how to have orgasms. I'm like, say no more. I have this fantastic editor who's working with us, Lauren Banz, who was at GQ and she's a TV writer. And so
The Spread loves Lauren.
Oh, God, she's so good. I love her so much. So she was available to us because of the writer's strike. So we brought her in to be an editor and she knew a writer in LA who was willing to do it, another TV writer. And so this woman went off and had a session with a man called the O-Man. He was a physical trainer. He became an orgasm coach and she paid $800. It was a low price because it was like a holiday discount. And she had 2 hours of orgasms. I don't know how many there were, but I would say probably safely 40. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but it was certainly over 20. She was exhausted, but it was hilarious. My phone went crazy the morning it happened. And I was getting texts from men who lead entertainment divisions of giant companies. They're like, whoa, this should be a TV series.
Yeah, it should. But
I talked to one person in that world about it. So I'm hoping so. Yeah.
First cross.
Yeah.
So you've invented Allure in your early 30s. You created BD Publishing and then you worked on the corporate side. If you had all the funding in the world, what would you create?
I do feel like I should create a skincare line. I even have a name. I have a concept. I know. But the market is so oversaturated. I feel like what needs to happen in skincare is something that just doesn't happen often enough. And that is the marriage of science with sexiness. There is no sexy science. And it should be. We should have products that perform really well and in a legitimate way and that are fun and well packaged and fun to name and look at and put on your counter and that you look forward to using. But they should also deliver on the performance. And it's very separate in the beauty world. It's either it's clinical and it looks clinical and it sounds clinical, or else it's frivolous and indulgent and luxurious, but it really doesn't do anything. And so I would love to do a mashup of those things. But I don't know. I think that to do it, I just think there's so much in the industry right now. And then we had this influx of celebrity lines, and I get it. I know that in order to get attention, you need a celebrity behind your brand. And in order to get attention, you need an influencer behind your brand. And that was one of the negatives about Flesh, was we didn't have that. It wasn't an influencer brand and it wasn't a celebrity brand. And so it's hard to get brand recognition and awareness without that. But right now, a lot of these celebrity brands are dying and a lot of the influencer brands are dying. So I think that there needs to be a bit of a shakeout and then maybe I'll do it. Who knows?
So you just solved skincare. Can you solve magazine?
I know.
If you were in charge of Conde Nast now, what would you do? Or can magazines be saved?
I think that they can be, but I think that they can't be in the model that, I'm not saying anything that's so ingenious. The business model is beyond broken. And there's no point in trying to force magazines into the current business model, which I think the surviving magazines are still trying to do. And they're trying to be all things to all people or a lot of things to all people. And I think when you look at some of the really exciting creative magazines, it's like Gentlewoman or Om Girls or Beauty Papers or Self Service. They're really specific. They drill right into their subject. They're not all disparate. They're very focused. And they feel precious. They're expensive. and they're on really good paper and they don't come out every month. So I feel like in a dream, it would be having a lot of little magazines that speak to a smaller consumer and then maybe have more to it than just the magazine. You look at Om Girls and they have clothes, or you look at Self-Service and they have exhibitions. Is there another something they could do? Airmail has these newsstands and they're opening another newsstand in March. And what does a journalism brand selling products look like? And can that be done? And it's breaking the old habits of selling a lot, having a lot of advertisers. Get one advertiser. The Airmail model of having a single advertiser per issue is really attractive. It's a very luxurious experience. The advertisers are the absolute highest luxury, and it looks good for Airmail and it looks good for the advertiser. It's a really happy marriage. And so that to me is like a really good solution. And doing fast on digital, but keeping, it's like slow food, keeping the slow part of it be the magazine and the contemplative part of it and the more artistic part of it. Or creative. There's probably no money to be made there, but
I think you just articulated the future of spread media. Are you ready, Mary?
Let's sidebar about this later. In the meantime, I have a very important question. So actually, our final question for you is, I bet, or we bet, that people ask you beauty questions all the time. So what is the one that you get the most?
The one about the neck. Everybody asks me, and that's probably my age too, but really the question I get more than anything else is, I want to get my eyes done. What should I do about my neck? Nora Ephron hit it when she said, I feel bad about my neck. That's every woman who's ever been on a Zoom call, unless you're under 35. So I think that's the thing I get. And I have one friend who is in the film industry who texts me once a year and says, who should I get to do my eyes? And I have to go back in my file and look who I sent her last time. Hey, you should go to this guy. And we just repeat it. It's like Groundhog Day every year. So it's all about plastic surgery. It's about injections. It's about lasers. I went to a dinner party on Friday night of extraordinarily accomplished women, and that's what they want to talk about. And I was talking to Anna Deavere Smith at this party, to drop a name, but she was like, why isn't there a Kennedy honor for beauty? I'm like, yeah, pitch me that.
You can find Linda Wells at Airmail Look and on Instagram at LindaWellsNY.
And don't miss out on the best reads of the week every week at The Spread on Substack.
If you'd like to connect more deeply with our guests, be sure to visit our website, where we have complete transcripts of all our interviews, along with portfolios, archival photos, links, and other great information. Visit longliveprint.co/interviews for more. Print is dead. Long live print. Is a member of the Hub and Spoke Audio Collective, a nonprofit association of audio storytellers dedicated to promoting and sustaining high-quality independent podcasting, including Out There, a podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors.
The race is called Infinitus, but in my head, I call it Infinitus, like an inflammation in your infinity gland.
That's journalist and runner Jordan Werfsbrock. And in this episode, she explains to Out There host Willow Belden why not finishing a 500-mile race through the Green Mountains of Vermont turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to her. You can hear the whole story at outtherepodcast.com and learn more about Hub and Spoke at hubspokeaudio.org.
Print is dead. Long live print is made possible by support of listeners like you. If you'd like to contribute to keeping the podcast going, there are two easy ways. One, become a sustaining patron by making a monthly donation. Or two, make a one-time donation in the amount that works best for you. Visit printisdead.co/support for more information.
Print is dead. Long live print is a production of Modus Operandi Design. For more information, visit our website, printisdead.co. Or if you're an optimist, longliveprint.co. Follow us on social media at printisdeadpod. Please give us a like and a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps. Thanks very much for listening.